This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to another Joy 94.9 podcast. This podcast is a summary of the weekly program. Due to copyright restrictions, the music has been edited to make this podcast possible.
Hello and welcome to the Outland Institute, episode 21B. Yes, it's a show so nice they named it twice, but they called 1A and 1B to show some sort of distinction between the two, otherwise it would just be confusing. In 21A, you heard such exciting things as Narell M. Harris telling us about some books you could buy for Christmas. For anyone who might be interested in books, you could also perhaps, go to our website and look at their wish lists for Book Depository and Amazon.co. Anyway, in this continuation of the show, you'll be hearing such exciting things as Glenn Dunks doing his roundup of the Australian films of 2009, which actually nearly killed him. That's an interesting story and one that amuses me greatly. Plus, Craig McLaughlin. Yes, Craig Neighbours McLaughlin. Craig Check 1-2 McLaughlin. Craig Bugs McLaughlin will be in to present the best ever crime against pop. It does involve a mighty organ, so look forward to plenty of double entendre. You'll also hear the conclusion to this week's musical challenge, which you, the podcast listener, can't really take part in anyway, so it's a bit abstract. You will hear the end of something you weren't taking part in that you haven't been able to hear. But, yeah, copyright. Woo! First up, though,
The Outland Institute.
It's time to talk film. We talk film with Glenn Dunks. Hello, Glenn.
Hello, John.
We're near the end of the year, and we're near the end of season one of The Outland Institute. Things are wrapping up a bit, aren't they?
They are. So it's that time of the year.
It is. It's the time when everyone's brain just starts shutting down. So speaking of which, what are you here to talk about?
Well...
Yeah, that was just rude.
Well, it is the end of the year, and I wanted to put a spotlight on one of the better trends of film this year. Mm-hmm. One of your favourite topics, I know, Australian cinema.
What is the gist this year with Australian cinema?
Well, basically, 2009 proved to be one of the best years for Australian film that there's ever been, basically.
So, I've got to admit, that does slightly depress me because I actually didn't see a single Australian film this year because there was nothing that interested me, with the exception of Brand New Day, which I don't know if I've missed.
That comes out in January next year. So you haven't missed... It's the next decade. Mm-hmm. Let's not go there yet. It is a good movie, though. I saw it at the film festival. Mm-hmm. But this year there was so many really great titles and really diverse ones, too. Usually we make the same sort. There's the... So idea of Australian cinema is that we just keep making the same movie over and over again.
That's what I feel for this year. I feel that there was just the same kind of the precious eggs, the same...
Yes, those precious eggs.
The same maudlin semi-art house,
Yeah, with the sheen of cinema, that great cinematography with the light reflecting off things.
Yeah, but no actual ideas or concepts or anything I hadn't seen before. But am I wrong? What did I
miss? Well, there were some really great movies this year. My favourite was actually a movie that I saw in 2008. It didn't actually get released until this year. It was Three Blind Mice, written and directed by Matthew Newton. Mm-hmm. It was about three soldiers before they head off to the Iraq War. With their last night in Sydney. It's a really great movie. I think literally about 20 people went and saw it.
Admittedly, that one actually did sound interesting.
Well, we discussed it on a previous show. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, it's a shame that not enough people went and saw it because it's a stunning movie, and it's my favourite of the year so far, not only of Australian films, but films in general.
Presumably, it will be either out on DVD or is out on DVD?
No, it's not out yet, but okay. It will be soon. The big title that everyone... that it was the buzz title of the year. It was Samson and Delilah. Everyone's heard of this one. Not everyone went and actually saw it, but they should have. Warwick Thornton wrote, he directed, he did the cinematography, he did the music. And it's another example of a stunning Australian film. It won the Camera d'Or at Cannes, which is the award that goes to the best first film. Of a filmmaker, and it's been submitted as Australia's entrant for the Best Foreign Language Film Academy Award, and he is hoping that it gets nominated. It would be great that Samson Delilah becomes our first ever nominee in that
category. For foreign language, that's
yeah, we've only ever submitted a few films. Because we generally don't make movies in other languages.
Ten Canoes, I'm guessing? Did we put
Ten Canoes was submitted, yes. La Spagnola, few years before
that.
Oh, that
was a bad film.
It wasn't that great, but the director, Steve Jacobs, actually made another film this year, and it was actually much better. It was called Disgrace, and it starred John Malkovich. In that time-honored tradition of bringing in an international actor to make our movies more appealing to audiences, they got John Malkovich in this movie that's set in South Africa. It's about South Africa. There's pretty much nothing Australian about it except the crew. It was another fine film. And John Malkovich, I think, is perhaps his best ever performance in it. That'll be out soon on DVD.
I've got to be honest, we have discussed this before too, but for me, an Australian film has to have Australian accents. I think that is actually what I come down on the end going. Yeah. If it has the sound of the Australian accent, go with it. So many of these films
I reckon it was. I reckon it was that, the fact that it's not... big, you know, Australia. No big Australian actors. It's not about Australia. I think it's that reason that it was snubbed entirely by all the awards that have been going on lately, the AFIs and the IFF awards.
It did
didn't get a single nomination at all. It actually did really well at the box office. But yeah, no one took it. Not even John Malkovich, which was a shame. Lake Mungo. This is another movie that no one has heard of, I assume. It was a supernatural movie. It was very much in the vein of something like the upcoming Paranormal Activity, in that it uses video footage from camcorders that a family has taken as they investigate the thought that there's a ghost in their house.
Okay.
But it's done like a documentary, and it's really creepy. It's hard to explain why exactly. I think the fact that it's done as a documentary helps kind of make the audience believe it a bit more, because ghosts in general aren't really... they're ghosts. They're not... What are you going to do? But yeah, this one is actually really, really well done. Animation. That's not really something Australian cinema does very often, but with Mary and Max from Adam Elliot, we haven't made that many, but it's pretty much the best one we have.
I mean, and again, you correct me, an Australian film I was interested in seeing and somehow just didn't. But yes, I did want to see Mary Max.
Well, it's really, really great. The writing from Adam Elliot is really superb. It's the first half especially is hilarious, and it features some really great voice acting by the likes of Philip Seymour Hoffman and Toni Collette and Eric Benner. There were a couple of movies that aimed more for the mainstream audience, less the art house. They were Mao's Last Dancer and The Boys Are Back. I actually think they did a really good job of being on that line of trying to be commercial and the kind of movie that people actually pay $14 to go see at a cinema, but also just being really nicely done films.
Mao's Last Dancer, again, I've heard it's really good, but does it fail my accent test?
There's some of the supporting characters.
Isn't this weird, though, that all the best Australian films now are the ones without Australian voices in them? It's like we're so ashamed of our own voice.
A little bit.
Yeah, literally. Yeah. We're literally ashamed that we
Well, see, the thing is, the Mao's Last Dancer is based on a the memoirs of this man who now is an Australian citizen. He lives here and he has an Australian family with an Australian wife. And he ended up being in the ballet here, but at the time that the movie is set...
But that's all it after,
was,
isn't it?
Yeah, in the movie is set when he was in America and China. So there's not much you can really do about that.
Doesn't have a flashback at the beginning when he's on a tram, you know, eating a meat pie. No. And you know...
Although you can tell where some bits that were filmed in Australia, which it's nice. Oh, I think I know that beach.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Pretending to not be Australia?
Yes. Okay. Yes, and pretending to be Houston, Texas.
Oh, yeah, I love that.
I was really surprised in Charlie in Boots.
I was going to ask you about this because, admittedly, this is the third film coming out. I was actually interested in seeing, partly out of sheer spite with the rest of the Australian movies,
yes,
that were all precious eggs that did not care if the audience came or not.
No.
And I find that there's a certain arrogance to making a film with not the slightest bit concerned whether or not an audience actually has any interest, not trying to give anything to an audience, not caring, because it's your precious egg.
Mm.
And so Charlie in Boots came out, and I was actually tempted to go, look, it's a film actually aiming to have an audience. It yes. wants people to go and see it.
And it got an audience, not as large an audience as perhaps they were hoping. It made nearly $4 million.
But it seemed to have virtually no publicity and still made $4 million.
Yeah, it was, well, that's what happens when you cast people that people actually want to see in movies.
And you can tell them it's a road movie and it's a comedy. I think it was comedy.
It's got Paul Hogan and... Oh, it's got Crocodile Dundee and Kenny.
And Kenny. Was it any good?
It was, actually. It's really well done, actually. I didn't see the director's first movie, which was Strange Bedfellows.
Oh.
Which was the one about two straight men pretending to be gay.
It's not good.
No, but this one, I imagine, is much better than that one. It's actually really sweet, really well acted and written, and it's charming. And yeah, it's the sort of movie you would actually like to see on like a Friday night at the movies. Mm-hmm. It was really well done.
I don't think we've ever talked about Strange Bedfellows, have we, on the show?
I haven't.
Seen it, and it's...
Oh, you have? Oh.
Well, it's curious, though, because... It is based on a patently offensive concept. The concept
is that
the gays get special privileges. That's basically the central premise of the film. However, after that offensive premise, it goes out of its way not to be offensive, which makes it really odd. Like, it just feels like such a strange movie to go, okay, you've started with an offensive premise, but you don't want to offend me, and you've now ended up so confused that, weirdly enough, you would have been better off as a homophobic rabble-rousing comedy.
Yeah. One more movie I want to mention. I haven't seen it yet. It hasn't come out yet. But it's Jane Campion's Bright Star, which I think will be really good. It's getting lots of buzz over in America where it's been released. It's Jane Campion's quote-unquote comeback. It's a period movie starring Abby Cornish about poet John Keats. It's meant to be really... really well done. So
I'm say, you're not winning me over so far, but maybe
maybe it's not your sort
it
of
might,
movie.
It may just be that it's not my film. Yeah.
But of course, with all the good, there has to be bad, doesn't there?
Oh,
it's
dear.
Australian cinema, of course. Okay. There's going to be bad. Van Diemen's Land. Oh, poor Van Diemen's Land. I coined a new phrase for this one. It's called art house horror porn. It's for people, for art house audiences who like the thrill of horror movies, but like to be able to afterwards nod their head and go, yes.
Yeah.
It was an analogy for the way British colonialists...
Right, yes.
...treat some stupid stuff like that.
Yeah. It's excusable, isn't it?
Yeah.
I guess it's a porn film, but be excused for seeing a porn film.
It's dreadful. Absolutely dreadful.
I was in the kino with my partner, and curiously, the trailer came on. I can't remember what we were seeing, but the trailer. And this is the only experience I've ever had of this. The very first shot in the trailer was an extreme close-up in profile of a mouth biting into some meat with some
That's pretty much the opening line of the movie.
Some quite amazing Foley work. So there's... And within the first couple of seconds, Chris and I turned to each other and said, not seeing that. And I've never seen a trailer that managed to actually make the majority
turn
of the audience.
Within seconds, yes.
Turn off and go, nah.
Another one is Blessed from our good old friend,
Anna
Kokkinos.
We should get Anna Kokkinos in sometime.
oh, don't torture me with that idea.
We should get Anna Kokkinos in one of those, those things they have at fairgrounds where you have to throw the balls at the target and then the person falls into the water. I think that...
Yeah, it's a dunking machine.
Be good. The Anna Kokkinos dunking machine.
The only thing that really saved Bless was the performances. There was actually some good performances in this movie. I will give it that.
Mm-hmm.
But... Oh, It's an Anna Kokonos movie. Yeah, you know what to expect.
Yeah, and I guess you know if you like that sort of thing.
Yeah. Closed for Winter. A movie I don't think anyone again would have heard of. It came out towards the start of the year. It stars Natalie Imbruglia.
Can I say Closed for Winter is one of the worst titles I could imagine? That's like calling a film Please Don't Come. You know, Closed for Winter. Can I guess the poster? Was it an empty beach?
Yes.
Really?
Yes. With Natalie Imbruglia's giant floating head.
What?
She like floats above the beach. But this movie, from what I can remember, Natalie Imbruglia's character has the power, the supernatural power, to immerse herself in flashbacks just by staring out of a window. Like, seriously, every 10 minutes, they cut to her, she does some stuff, and then she stares out a window into her own reflection, cut to a flashback of 20 years ago where the tragedy of the movie happened. It's
funny how so many Australian films really boil down to just get over it. Yes. You know, it's like so many, like, oh, it's a torture.
Yes, exactly.
Like, something happened so long ago. Get over it. You know, we don't care. No one cares.
Speaking of supernatural, though, Crush. A movie about, I'm not joking here, an American taekwondo performer who gets involved with a sexy bikini-clad girl with supernatural powers.
That sounds brilliant.
It's really not. I thought it was going to be, but it is not. It is so boring. A movie about a taekwondo player and a girl with supernatural powers should not be boring. No, and it is. It's terrible in every single way. I didn't understand it at all.
Did that actually come out to cinemas?
It came out to cinemas in Perth. It was filmed in Perth, so I think they had some contract. But other than that, no.
Such a proud industry.
Went DVD elsewhere. The worst one, though.
Worse.
Oh, there are worse. Perhaps the worst movie Australia has ever produced.
That's big. That's
it's
a big order.
It's a big call, I know. Yeah. It's called Salvation, and it's from director Paul Cox. He is.
Yeah, see, now I'm with you.
he's a known director in the way that he makes movies frequently.
In the way that Ebola is a known virus, I think is what you're trying to say there.
But like, I've liked some of his stuff. And
you don't walk into a sewer outlet and expect it to smell nice.
No.
So if you go into a cinema with a Paul Cox movie.
But see, this man has done some good stuff. But this movie, Salvation, is abominable in every way. It's a movie that makes fun of religion. And I'm not a religious person, but even I was offended at how stupid it was. It's vile. It's so mean-spirited as well. Like I like a good anti-religion joke as much as anyone. But why make something so obviously offensive to so many people and something that's just so obviously done in this bizarre camp manner? It's horrible in every way. It's vile. Absolutely vile. I hate it. I hate it even more than Footy Legend. I'm sorry. This has gone a bit haywire. But
it's started off so well. Let's celebrate the great things of Australian cinema this year. Oh, so much good stuff in Australian cinema. And now we're just kicking a dead horse.
Poor Australian cinema.
So let's all just go back to the happy place where we're at the beginning of this all.
The happy movies.
So, I mean, obviously these will come out in DVD. What's your top recommendation? What should I be going out now and watching from your happy films at the beginning?
Three Blind Mice when it does. Yep. Samson Delilah when it comes out, I think next week. Cedar Boys, which is it's a very much a mainstream thriller movie about a heist and gangsters. It's really great fun movie. And yeah, definitely try and check out that Lake Mungo. I think you might get a few scares out of that one.
Thank you so much for joining us. If I want to read more of your film writing, where would I go?
You can go to stalepopcornau.blogspot.com.
And we'll see you next week.
Thank you.
The Outland Institute.
Time for a bit of a recap on the show. Remember, there may be a quiz. Let's go first on today's musical challenge. The songs you've heard thus far are I Know What Boys Like by The Waitresses, Home and Dry by The Pet Shop Boys, Waiting by Ben Queller. That is, of course, a cover of Beatles song. That comes from This Bird Has Flown, a 40th anniversary tribute to the Beatles' Rubber Soul. Waiting for a Dream by Rufus Wainwright. He's gay. Hooray! And Missing You by John Waite. I want to mention, actually, Missing You was a song I hadn't heard since I was about 8, and then I went to Las Vegas for my 30th birthday, because that's what you do. And in Las Vegas, they play Missing You by John Waite roughly every 24 minutes. I heard that a lot. Strange enough, when I went to Austin, Texas, everybody Wang Chung tonight. Why, Austin, Texas, are you obsessed with everybody Wang Chung tonight? I don't understand. As far as Australian films go, a few people commented, got these Paul from Port Melbourne, I've got Jenny. People were saying, what about Beautiful Kate? Actually, Paul rang in to say these were good films he wanted to mention, Beautiful Kate and My Year Without Sex. He thought we'd left those off the list. Jenny just sent in, what about Beautiful Kate? But I'm not quite sure if she said that in when we were talking about good films or bad films. So I'm guessing Jenny probably liked it. I'm going with that. And the other story I mentioned at the beginning of the show, that piece with Glenn Dunks just then, was actually pre-recorded. We did that a couple of days ago because he couldn't come in today. Towards the end of it, I thought Glenn was just getting excited. You know, he loves film. We all love film. He's passionate about it. I thought that's why he was going red and breathless. Turns out, anaphylactic shock. Yeah. Ambulances. St. Vincent's Hospital nearly killed him. Beaten, of course, by man's oldest enemy, cake. Yes, sharks of the land, cake. But we will tell you more about that next week. We have our very... Oh, I can see him. I can see him through the window. He's wearing a singlet, so he's making his little titties dance for me. Ah. He's shameless. Joining us now for Crimes Against Pop. This is so exciting. This is way too exciting, really. This is unbelievably exciting. Joining me in the studio, you might know him as Henry Ramsey from Neighbours. You perhaps might know him from Home and Away, where he played Grant Mitchell. You might know him as the character on Bugs, whose name I didn't bother looking up. You may well even know him as playing Billy Flynn in Chicago, the musical, which you have 4 more chances to see his excellent performance. Will probably help if I turn the right microphone on. Craig McLaughlin, welcome.
John, thank you. Do you know, I'm in the market for a new publicist. Remind me not to give you a call. The guy from Bugs, whose name I didn't bother looking up, yeah. Folks, just in case you're wondering.
Oh, no one remembers that show here anyway, Craig.
Yeah, I know, but in case they're... Listen, we get a lot of visitors, don't we, from
overseas.
From Britain.
From the UK.
For those of you who remember, Edward, abbreviated to Ed, of course, the surname Case.
Ed Case. You were
Say
Ed
no
Case.
More.
That's brilliant.
Isn't that good?
That's great.
Lovely.
Now, we're not going to interview about your work because we have already prepared one earlier.
Yes.
You can hear, and I should point out that Josh Canal has unofficially snuck back in. Hello, Josh Canal.
Unofficially, hello.
You thought that introduction was for you, but
I did.
It's not.
I was very excited to hear that I had 4 more performances to go in Chicago.
Yeah, but you don't. No.
Just as well, because I have something on tonight.
That's good. Yeah.
Yes, he's rearranging the sock drawer, folks.
It's still something, Craig McLaughlin. We can't all just be on stage at Her Majesty's Theatre. Tickets available now.
Exhibition Street.
Josh, Brett Cropley and myself have interviewed you at length, we must say, on the Box Cutters podcast. If you go to boxcutters.net, episode 203, I'm thinking. So we've got you in instead.
Yes.
To talk about, this is Crimes Against Pop. This is the segment where
you've got one of pop's ultimate criminals.
Well, this is what I was going to ask you, because this is the segment we play music, we mock it. Now, you're a gentleman who has been mocked for your music.
Please, mock's my middle name.
But this is, does it make you angry? I mean, because Check 1-2 did sell.
Craig McMocklin.
They sold millions of records worldwide. Do you want to go stop mocking at people until you've sold a gold record?
Well, it's funny, isn't it? I think we mentioned on Box Cutters the other day, we all held hands around the microphone and I uttered the immortal words, better to have had a hit than to have never had a hit at all. But you know, look, it's funny because the grief that I cop over Mona, I'll say the name loud and proud, Mona, it seems to really only exist in Australia, but that's kind of our way, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
But you're right, it was and I hadn't thought too much about it until we were chatting about it the other day, Box Cutters. It was hugely successful, but at the time, we, the band, the ludicrously named, I admit, Check 1-2, we were so, you know, two guys from the central coast of New South Wales and one ring-in, but that's another story for another day. We were so we were just caught up in the mad chaos of it all. Mona was kind of, that whole period was kind of a blur for me. But what's really interesting, and it's funny because I had such a lovely, lovely time with you guys the other day, and I know I apologised at the time for rabbiting on, and I'll probably have to apologise again today. But it brought up so many memories for me. And, you know, the funny thing, too, about having hit records is I think the first record, the Check 1-2 single that Sony released, or CBS as they were released, was a thing called Rock the Rock. Now, here's a lyric for you, folks. You want to talk about crime against pop? Let me lay this on you. Rock the Rock, a lyric by Garth Porter, who famously co-wrote How's That for Sherbet, in fact most of their big hits. This was Garth's lyrical contribution to the music that I wrote that ultimately became Rock the Rock. Chorus. Rock the rock, roll the roll, beat the beat, soothe my soul. Now, if that isn't a crime against pop, I don't know what is. And of course, the outtakes, which I would have much preferred had been released, you can imagine. Well, just think for a moment.
Yeah, but it's, you know, it's not Shakespeare's sonnets that's going to get you on Countdown week after week.
Exactly. Right? And Molly said that to me in the jacuzzi after my first appearance. Funny, he had an interesting lyric to Rock the Rock, let me tell you. But you're right. But you know what is funny too, Josh, is that, you know, Rock the Rock, actually it did really well in Melbourne. You know, and it charted in the other states, but internationally, the record company, you know, they followed suit. They released Rock the Rock, and when you have kind of a, you know, a top 40 placing, you know, a reasonable sort of hit, they'll fly you to a territory, economy class up the back of Uzbekistani Airlines. Suddenly, when you get a top 10 hit, you've stepped up to Qantas. So, and this is not about product placement, folks, but they step you up to a
name brand.
Thank you,
airline.
And you're not sitting in the back row, you're sitting somewhere in the middle. Suddenly you get a top 5 placing in the UK and you're at the back of business. Suddenly the album goes top 5, you've got 2 singles in the top 20 or top 10, and a single hanging around at the number 2 spot in Britain for, you know, a Fernando-esque amount of time. And suddenly it's first class all the way. Well, suddenly a few singles later, you're back somewhere in the top 30. And it's business.
So you can actually judge it by your place in the plane.
As soon as I get the ticket, I would go, we're not charting well in Europe, guys, based on this. Mark, you and John are swimming to Hong Kong and then catching Air China to wherever.
I remember Massive Attack once saying that as long as they kept getting the sort of fruit and muffin basket at Christmas from their record company, they knew they were still signed. Like, they were never sure until this turned up.
Absolutely.
ABBA had their own plane. They must have been like royalty.
They must have been like ABBA.
Yeah, they must have been as big as ABBA,
yeah. If not bigger.
Anyway, speaking of which, we will run out of time, unfortunately. You are here for Crimes Against Pop. You have chosen a quite fabulous subject. Now, who are we going to be listening to today, Craig McLaughlin?
Folks, before you reach for your radios and change, what do you say, channels, or roll your dial or turn your dial? Don't, because I'm about to introduce you. Those of you who have never heard of this guy, you're in for a treat. Klaus Wunderlich. Klaus Wunderlich, who most famously, I think, perhaps in this territory, in Australia, was best known in the 60s, early 70s, for his Hammond a Go-Go work. Hammond, of course, folks, I refer to an organ.
A mighty organ.
Thank you, John. Folks, you can't see the way John's looking at me when he says mighty
Craig
organ.
Craig McLaughlin's mighty organ.
Thank you.
He's famous for Hammond organ. He's recorded in Phase 4 stereo, I believe, a few times, which is always exciting.
Always exciting.
I do love the Phase 4 stereo albums have the most amazing covers. You can find them in op shops. And my favourite one is Organised, which I don't think is Klaus, but it's got little go-go dancers dancing on an enormous keyboard.
Brilliant.
Later on in his career, he also experimented a lot with Moog synthesizers.
He did, yes. He was willing to break through that barrier. How did you find Klaus? How were you introduced to the work of
How was Wunderlich? I introduced to the work of Klaus Wunderlich? Mm-hmm. There was a guy who lived down the road where I grew up in a kid on the kind of north central north coast of New South Wales. There was a guy who lived down the road from our family home. His name was Dick Rosa. Great name, isn't it? Dick Rosa. Anyway, Dick had an organ. And I would...
This has just turned into blankety blanks.
It was going to happen. It was always going
to
happen.
I used to go down... I used to go down to Mr. Rose's for a GI cordial. Folks, that was the green lime cordial, for those of you who are old enough to remember GI cordial. An iced Vovo, and watch Mr. Rosa play his organ. Not a very good player, but it was the full, you know, the double keyboard, yeah, classic kind of, I can't remember.
A two-hander.
Thank you very much. And in his record, and I, you know, he was almost a, I'm loath to say this about a guy whose name's Dick Rose, but he's almost like an extension of our family, if I can put it that way. So we maintained a relationship with him, God rest his soul, right up until he shuffled off. But I was rummaging through his collection of vinyl one day, and I came across this fantastic cover. I can't remember which Hammer to Go-Go Klaus record it was, but Klaus was in kind of a almost a Elvis Presley circa 1975 sequined, not jumpsuit, but suit, but caftan, but certainly following in that gaudy 70s Vegas Elvis style of sequencing and patterning and stuff. And he had his arms stretched out wide and revealing this fabulous caftan behind him as this magnificent organ. And I said to Mr. Rosa, what's the deal here, Klaus? And he said, no, Klaus, let's put him on. And that was it. I was won over the swirling, sensational sonic sounds of the Leslie speaker. I've been a closet Klaus man ever since.
Now, you wanted to, you said you wanted to bring in the Klaus, has done ABBA. He's done many, many ABBA tracks. And
yes.
There's an album, I think, called The Winner, which is a compilation.
Yes.
And I'm going to play. I'll play it very quickly. This is part of Thank You for the Music. I think it's important we hear this.
I think so.
So here's Thank You for the Music by Klaus Wunderlich.
Listen to that simulated hi-hat. The shallow sound of the snare.
That is obviously fabulous. Mm. But as I was doing a bit of research with Klaus, I really wanted to trade you, Craig McLaughlin. So I want to trade you, Klaus, doing ABBA for something which I think is even more special, which is Klaus Wunderlich doing the theme from Shaft.
Because the theme from?
Shaft. Because, yeah, they say that Shaft is one mean mother.
Hey, watch your mouth.
Oh, but I'm talking about Shaft. And you can dig it. So what I really like is the idea. Here's a man famous for playing the organ. He's going, what am I going to cover that's going to be great in my album? I know. Isaac Hayes, funk classic, the theme from Shaft. But what if people get bored halfway through? I know. I'll make it a medley of If You Could Read My Mind by Gordon Lightfoot. It's the obvious way. It's what we all would have done in the same situation. Let's have a listen now. So today's Crime Against Pop is actually going to be Klaus Wunderlich doing the theme from Shaft. Thank you. We are so totally out of time. We could talk about Klaus Wunderlich all day, and I think from hearing that, you'd want to. That was the first time you heard that, Craig McLaughlin?
I'd never heard his version of Shaft, but interestingly enough, and I didn't know this until a few days ago, Klaus, the Austrian history of the name Klaus, I had no idea, translated, is funky. And Wunderlich, I had no idea, meant wrists.
Funky wrists.
Funky wrists, and I think that's evident in listening to Klaus.
One of the listeners wrote in, "The horror that is Klaus was a favourite of my dad. It resulted in Dad buying a Yamaha organ and sending me off to organ school. The horror is flooding back." That's Rick and Carlton. Thank you, Rick.
Sorry.
"This has made my life complete. Thank you for Klaus and Shaft," is another message we got in. And we also, that was from Cade. Chad said, "The intro is like one of those 70s dubbed martial arts films where the hero in a white suit jumps off the boat and strides through the small Thai village while the credits play across the screen." Brilliant.
Yeah.
We should also say that Chad also got the correct answer. Today's musical challenge was all about waiting.
What a surprise, Chad.
He's a winner. So, Missing You by John Waite. See what I'm doing there? Waiting for a Dream by Rufus Wainwright. Waiting by Ben Crowler. In Home and Drive by the Pet Shop Boys. Neil Tennant's Waiting for His Lover to Come Back from LA. And I Know What Boys Like by the Waitresses. They're professional waiters. Yeah, they're waiting for that whole waitresses revival to kick back in. Good luck, girls.
I just wanted to say I'm writing a short play about the rivalry between Klaus Wunderlich and his organ a go-go, James Last, and his trumpet a go-go.
Oh, that'd be brilliant.
Oh, brilliant.
Oh, I'm so there. Thank you so much for coming in, Craig McLaughlin.
James Last, it's a whole other...
There's a whole world. There's a world opening up, a world of terrible music. Thank you all for listening. Thank you for joining us. We'll see you next week.
And for more of the Outland Institute, visit outlandinstitute.wordpress.com. This has been another Joy 94.9 podcast. You can support Joy by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
She's a good egg.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.